Thank you. I know this is a topic that people are probably on overload about already, but hopefully I'll share with you. It's not going to be, I'm not talking about pornography, I'm not talking about some of the more obvious things. I want to talk a little bit about some of the new neuroscience research on digital technology. And I'm not going to focus enough on the positives, which are tremendous. I want to focus a little bit on some of the invisible challenges. So I'll start with some fascinating work comparing World War II to Vietnam. In World War II, one out of four soldiers were unable to kill the first time they were in combat, which is a huge problem. It meant that the United States was effectively losing 25% of their fighting force. Huge issue. I don't even know if we could have won the war so easily, not that we won it easily, but it could have had a very different outcome if that was allowed to continue. So they had to have special training programs in the United States Army built in at the very beginning to teach men how to kill. When the Vietnamese War started, it seemed to make sense to have the same kind of programs, because why not? And they almost immediately canceled the program to teach the Vietnamese soldiers, the American soldiers in Vietnam, how to kill. Because what had changed in the intervening decades? Anybody want to guess? Television. I think it was a little before video games. Video games, I think they had Pong maybe then. It wasn't quite the same video games that we have today. But television. The concept of heritable, the concept of habituation. So that it became much easier to kill. So they canceled the program almost immediately. Now, the applicability to challenges in terms of our digital devices is pretty obvious. You don't need me to even explain it, but the reality is that I'll share with you a quick story. I was asked to give a talk in Manhattan to a group of parents of various modern Orthodox yeshivot in Manhattan. And the head of school of one of the many schools that were part of this program comes to me, and she tells me the following story. She says, in her school, half of the children by grade three, half of the children have smartphones. Okay, by third grade. It's a little alarming to me. But by fourth grade, 100% do. They all do. So she tells me that the week before I came to give that talk, there's a class of bunch of fourth graders, and she happens to walk in to stop by. And there's a fourth grade girl, it's a 10-year-old girl, and she's on her cell phone looking at pornographic pictures and sharing them with some of the other kids in this co-ed class. So she's horrified. She immediately goes over to her and says, what are you doing? And the kid looks up to her and says, what's wrong? She says, those are totally inappropriate pictures. What are you doing? What are you doing with that? She looks at her kind of puzzled and says, what's wrong? But like literally, no hakaras l'chait whatsoever, no shame. So she takes the iPhone 6 away from her. This just happened a few months ago. Predictably, what happens that night? Parent calls up, furious, and demands, how dare you take my daughter's phone away? She says, what are you doing in terms of talking to your children about appropriate, inappropriate, in terms of filters, in terms of monitoring, what are you doing? She says, what business is that of yours? She says, she just basically ended the phone call. What do you think happened the next morning? Next morning, the girl comes back to school with a brand new iPhone 6. Okay? Now, that speaks to a lot of issues. It speaks to changes that, thank God, haven't crossed the George Washington Bridge here yet. But I find that what happens in Manhattan eventually makes its way to this part of the world as well. But the first issue, though, is the issue of Heritage, the issue of the World War II versus Vietnam War change. It's a very, I think, a very important issue. What I want to share with you now, we have till 10 after, is a couple of thoughts. I'm going to talk a little bit about cognitive, social, some parenting issues, but first I want to share with you some recent research in neuroscience, brand new stuff that's been just coming out in the last year or two. And it's fascinating. It's extremely important work in terms of why these things have so much power over us. There's a book that came out just last year. I really recommend it, only because, especially if you have adolescents at home, it totally changed the way I view even talking on the phone when I'm driving, you know, even hands-free. Certainly, the issue of texting while driving. The name of the book is called A Deadly Wandering, A Deadly Wandering, W-A-N-D-E-R-I-N-G, by Matt Richtel, R-I-C-H-T-E-L, who won the Pulitzer Prize here for his reporting and writing on the subtle impact of technology, which is what I wanted to focus on this afternoon. So he talks about, it's a fascinating book, it reads like a novel, he talks about a very tragic texting accident going back about 5-6 years ago, where a 19-year-old boy in Utah, who's a wonderful boy from a wonderful family, a really solid kid, was driving on a highway in Utah, and he was texting, not even knowing that that would be problematic. And what he didn't realize is you really can't do two things at once. We'll talk a little bit later about how multitasking is literally, truly impossible. It's true we always multitask, but I'll talk to you a little bit about some of the research on that. And because he was sending texts back and forth to his girlfriend, he momentarily lost sight of what he was doing. His car swerved into another part of the highway and he killed two men, both of them prominent rocket scientists who had young children at home, both of them wonderful members of the community, wonderful husbands, and they happened to be very, very prominent men whose work really mattered to the world beyond the norm. They were like among the leading minds in rocket science in the world. So it caused a tremendous amount of damage. And the book talks about his odyssey from not even realizing what he was doing to understanding the depth of what he did. But let me just share with you some of the neuroscience in the book, because this is brand new stuff, and he very artfully weaves the story of this young man who did a full tshuva, unbelievable tshuva, now is one of the leading advocates against texting and driving in the country, and had laws changed in different parts of the country, but he weaves it together with some of the new neuroscience. Very, very readable book, very hard to put down. So here's just some basic new research. Texting increases chance of a car accident sixfold. It's actually more dangerous than driving drunk. And that there's pretty good science showing that. And that's surprising when you think about it. If you want to try a little experiment between my talk and when Dr. Tversky comes in here, there's something called the cocktail party test that attention researchers do, which is as you're talking to each other after I finish, and before Rabbi Dr. Tversky comes up here, who I just had the pleasure of hearing in the Five Towns this morning at the parallel program, great talk. Please stay for it. It's wonderful. So he'll probably give a totally different talk because he has 65 of his books to choose from. But the cocktail party test goes like this. Talk to whoever you're talking to, but with part of your mind multitask. Try to eavesdrop a little bit at the same time on a conversation of somebody near you. So they've done a lot of research on this. And this is common sense. When you think about it, it just shows how silly multitasking is. It is literally impossible for you to really hear what the other person is saying in any real way if you're really talking and attending to the other person. You might be able to tell the gender of the other conversation, and if your name is mentioned, you'll hear that. But otherwise, all the research shows you can't tell. Yet, if you ask the average student who's checking texts, doesn't matter if it's in a high school class or a university class or graduate school class, they'll say, no, I can do two things at once. And yet we know that even if you're watching the crawl on the bottom of the screen when you watch CNN or Fox, your comprehension goes down by between 40 and 50%. But what's interesting about it is there's no hakara sechein. People think almost always that they're fine at doing two things at once. Since I read this book, I've been having a harder time driving and speaking on my hands-free phone because I've become a little too conscious of it. And I realize, though, that I'm probably, there's a reason why there's a fourfold increase in car crashes if you're driving and talking on the phone. And there's new research showing that that's true even if it's hands-free. And the reason you're able to talk to somebody in the car with you differently is that person is acting sort of as a shomer. So that if you're doing something stupid because you're talking to them and you're distracted, they'll say, hey, watch for that, watch out for that, whatever. Anyway, okay, here's a couple of things he found. Number one is that they're understanding now what is so seductive about these devices. And it's both top-down and bottom-up. Let me explain what that means. Top-down is the men in this room who put your Shul Rosh on this morning. Why do we focus so much on the Shul Rosh? It's going right over the frontal prefrontal cortex, the part of our brains that's involved in being human, the part of our brains that's involved in problem-solving and planning and thinking about our day and in our judgment and our empathy. So it used to be that people would be pulled into TV shows or the plot of a TV line. It was very seductive for people who watch TV. But this is so much more seductive because it's the narrative and the story of our life. So if we're driving along and we hear that ping, and we know that it might be our son, our daughter, our father, our mother, our best friends, or whatever, it pulls us in because we're hardwired, and especially as Jews, we're connected. We're hardwired to be connected. So we literally need to look at it. That's the frontal part. But then there's also the primitive brain. The primitive brain is the part of the brain that would react if the door here opens and a rabid dog comes running in. We're not going to think. We're going to go right into fight or flight. And that's the primitive part of our brain immediately tells us what to do. And what the research is finding is that every time that little ping comes on or that little vibration comes on that we're thankfully free of every Shabbos, which I'll talk about in a minute, we automatically have that system, the bottom-up system, acts involuntarily. It's almost like we have to go for it. When you ever talk to somebody and they're talking to you, but they sort of unconsciously will take their phone out and look at it because it's the bottom-up system almost acting automatically. It's almost unconscious. Many wives often complain to me about their husbands speaking to them on the phone, and it could go in the other way as well, having an email voice. They're talking to their husband or they're talking to their wife, and they know that he or she has email voice, meaning that he's checking his text or checking his email, so he's there and he's not there. You all know the experience of what email voice sounds like. So the other thing that's coming up is that when the primitive system is responding automatically to the pain, there's a little release of dopamine. There's a spurt of dopamine, the research is showing, that comes into our brain. You know that feeling where Motzei Shabbos last night, you check your email? What the researchers are finding is you've been dry for 25 hours, right? You haven't looked at this thing for 25 hours. There'll be a little unconscious intake of breath and a little spurt of dopamine in your brain, similar to what happens when you take a drug. It's not addictive in the same way necessarily, although it can be, as being addicted to a drug, but it has many of the same characteristics. Yet, there's very little hakara sechet or understanding of this because it's so new. We haven't quite figured this stuff out. Listen to this. There's a field called neuroeconomics, right? It's led by Dr. Kahneman. Many of you might have read his book, Think Fast and Think Slow. He's the one who won the Nobel Prize for his work with Dr. Tversky, a cousin of our next speaker, who unfortunately died before he was able to get the Nobel Prize. He's the nephew of the Panovitcher Rebbe, Dr. Kahneman, the Nobel laureate, one of my favorite psychologists to read. So Dr. Kahneman's work and the work of others says the following. He does a very simple test. Let's say I was to offer you each $5 right now, or ask you to say, look, you could wait and I'll give you $100. At what point would it not be worth it to you to wait? Okay? So there's a lot of research showing usually about 4 months, 50% of people won't wait for the $100. They'll take the $5 now rather than wait 4 months, whatever the logic might be. But now they do the same thing with data. Let's say you get a text from a close friend or a family member, and I'll give you $5 if you look at the text right now, or I'll pay you to wait. So for the $100, the 50% point is about 4 months, I think 163 days or something like that. Do you know what the 50% point is for the same amount of money for a text message? 10 minutes. It's a very interesting kind of thought. There's an immediacy to this. We feel like we have to know. And it has to do with our connections. It has to do with exactly what we've been talking about. Okay, next. Let me move on to three other points. I see that I have to discipline my time here. Number one, being versus doing. Being versus doing, we all know how important that is. Listen to this study. This study is probably all I need to say about this, and then I'll move on to a couple of other major points. Being versus doing goes like this. We all know Shabbos is about being. The week is about doing. So listen to what these researchers did exactly a year ago, the July 4th issue of Science Magazine, I think it was 2014. They take people, they take away their cell phone, they put them in an empty room that has a chair and four walls, and they say, spend the next 15 minutes being alone with your thoughts, think about your life. That's all we're asking, think about your life. Fine, okay, makes sense. People hate it, nobody's surprised that they hate it. But where does this get interesting? It gets interesting when they take a subset of these people and they say, we're about to do a study, but it's going to involve electroshock, mildly painful electroshock. Are you willing to pay us a little bit of money not to be given electric shock? And anybody who's willing to pay them a certain amount of money not to be shocked, they take them for the experiment. They take that subset of people who really hate pain. I guess it's a lot of people. And they do the same thing with them. They put them alone in the room. They say, be alone with your thoughts. And they say, oh, by the way, we have an electric shock machine in the corner of this room. You don't have to touch it. It's totally up to you. But if you get really, really bored, you could shock yourself. Do you know that 67% of the men and 25% of the women chose to give themselves the mild electric shock rather than being alone with their thoughts? That's how the world has changed. And yet we need stillness, we need mindfulness in order to be creative, in order to connect to others. The essence of spirituality, as you'll hear from Rabbi Dr. Tversky very soon, is its connection. It's what makes us human, it's what makes us Jews. And yet, it's being taken away from us in an invisible way that we don't even necessarily know. Anybody in this room who's sort of like wondering, hey, can I check my phone? Can I check my phone? Am I missing something? Or you may hear a little ping in your pocket, a little either noise or vibration. It would be totally normal. You just want to check and you're going crazy. Maybe I'm missing something important. But the reality is that we need a cheshbon hanefesh to really think about who's in control of what. 1,000 years ago, Rabbeinu Bachya said the following four-word tefillah. Hashem yatzileni mipizur hanefesh. God save me from fragmentation of my soul. We're living in an age of fragmentation. Or in a similar vein, Moshe Tzvi Weinberg quotes the Baal Shem Tov as saying that one of the ways of looking at the two words that we say a couple of times every day in Kriya Shema, the Avadatem Mehera, in addition to the obvious real pshat of Avadatem Mehera, but Al Pidrush, it's get rid of the rush in your life. You need to take a step back and do a cheshbon hanefesh in those areas. For adolescents in particular, stillness is important. Being alone with your thoughts is important. And it's all tied to empathy. Empathy is slow. If I had decided to show you a PowerPoint presentation, and I'd show you a little video I have of a car door smashing on somebody's hand, immediately, everybody here would automatically wince. You wouldn't have to think. It's just part of us. You see somebody suffering physically, there's immediate empathy. But if I then show you a video of the same length of two people, one person hurting another person's feelings, you're not going to immediately have empathy. In order to have real empathy, you have to focus. In order to have the no se bol in chavero, you have to be there. You have to connect. And that requires focus, and that's what's shifting. It's shifting in parent-child relationships. It's shifting in peer relationships as communication between kids has shifted almost predominantly to texting rather than eye-to-eye and face-to-face. And as the kamayim apanim el panim of eye-to-eye, heart-to-heart communication goes down, research shows empathy level has gone down in our community. Well, in the general community, not just in us. Okay, by the way, you know, just a couple of months ago, the Pew Foundation did a study that chilled me. It was like, it really totally shocked me, because they're constantly doing studies about how much time are teenagers in the United States spending on devices. You know what they found just in the most recent survey? That 1 out of 4 adolescents, all adolescents are very connected to their device, but 1 out of 4 adolescents in the United States are literally always connected to their devices. In other words, they are never, there's never a waking moment that they're not connected to this. So not only are they always texting or whatever, they somehow are always connected, even in school. Their hands are in their pockets and they're texting without looking, which they could all, you know, many of them could do. Or maybe, I guess you need a BlackBerry to do that. Unless they, I think they seem to know how to do this stuff. But they also, there's even something now, I've been seeing a little show, something called sleep texting. That they sleep with the phone under their pillow and they sleep text. It doesn't make any sense. Their closest friends who wake up and find gibberish. But it's like during non-REM sleep, where they incorporate their dreams into text. So some of them, now even when they're sleeping, this has become the new way of being. And again, there's wonderful connection. There's a good kind of connection that comes with all of this. We just have to be aware of this cognitive areas. I won't spend much time other than to say that there's very little depth of thought when we're multitasking. When people multitask, it's more stressful, less efficient. If I showed you my slideshow, I'd show you a brain reading a book and doing nothing else. And very small parts of that brain are lit up, but it's deep thinking. You see, at a neurologic level, that brain is thinking deeply. The same brain reading a book while checking for texts and taking emails and taking phone calls is lit up all over the place. It's lit up everywhere, but it's a mile wide and an inch deep. There's no depth. It's superficial, and we're finding that's happening. You know, the 90% of United States educators in a recent study says that kids are far more distracted today than they were even very recently, okay? I could bore you with statistics, but it seems to be getting much worse. Even when I sometimes travel there, it's Israel. In some of the seminaries, many of the educators tell me, I don't know if you see this, that there's a tremendous shift in the ability of both the men and women studying in Eretz Yisrael for the year or 2 years or beyond, and their ability to focus. Because many of them are still tied to this in a way that they just can't seem to disconnect. Okay, let me, I see I'm in my last minute or so. Let me just talk about that in my best 5-10 minutes or so. Let me make recommendations for parents. I'm just going to make some simple recommendations and then I'll end with the story. Here's the recommendations for parents. Number one, you know what, I'm going to keep it simple. I'm going to just talk about making recommendations for parents of preschoolers, because it's a talk in itself just to talk about adolescents, where it's very hard to change. It's not that it's not possible, but it's harder. I don't know if you know that any child born after 2007 is called a digitop. What happened in 2007, everybody? Something world-changing happened to the worlds of our children. Anybody want to guess? iPhone. Before 2007, kids, little preschoolers, couldn't access computers unless their parents put them on the lap and taught them how to use the mouse, which wasn't so simple. From 2007 on, even little infants can take a hold of one of these or take a hold of an iPad and play apps and play games, and there's some good stuff that comes from it if it's very carefully mediated by parents. But it's shifted. Here's the recommendations just for preschoolers, because that's when you could really make a difference, in case any of you were grandparents or parents of preschoolers. And this is general recommendations. It goes like this. Number one, keep technology out of the bedroom as much as possible. When kids fall asleep with their devices nearby, the white light of the device interferes with sleep, and sleep is actually interfered in a way that really can impact on their day, forgetting all the other problems with it. Don't let children sleep with technology. Teach your children when they're young to ask permission to use technology. Harder to do with adolescents. But you know what? With the balance between small dochim and makareves, it would be wonderful if you could figure out how to do this even for your older kids. Even the most liberal child psychiatrists, child psychologists, and child mental health professionals are now saying that you have to limit weekday technology use based on your child's personality. You don't let them download and buy games by themselves. That should come with your supervision. And there are wonderful sites like Common Sense Media that'll help you pick the right kind of apps and media. You should oversee YouTube. There was a study done a couple of years ago in California where they asked a group of Yeshiva High School students, when you have teenagers of your own, how are you going to handle digital technology different than your parents? You know that more than half of the kids said that, you know what, when I have a teenager of my own, I'm going to be much stricter. And they then would write, you know how many pictures I saw that I shouldn't have, that I can't get out of my mind? They'd say, do you know how difficult it is for me to think about all the time I've wasted being up to 2, 3 in the morning, just wasting my time texting friends? And then there's the cruelty, the online disinhibition effect, the fact that we're much less likely to be kind to our friends and people we don't know when we're texting and we're communicating online. It's just much, much harder. Okay? We tend to be much nicer to another person when we see them face to face. But when there's no eye contact, it's much easier to be cruel. And that's another thing that people have to teach kids, and it's a challenge for educators. Don't permit technology use during meals. Tell your kids to report inappropriate game sites, etc. The idea being that what tends to work best is the balance between love and limits. You monitor in the context of a good relationship. And that tends to work the best. But mostly making technology a privilege, not a right. Very few families are doing this now. And it's sort of a thing that's gotten away from us. I think it's the greatest educational challenge of our time. It's shifting things. Even I see in the Hasidic community that's supposedly completely isolated in certain parts of upstate New York, you would not believe what comes into my office. You would not believe it. Let me end with a story. In early 1920s, Churchill was already a very famous man. I think he was foreign secretary in the UK. Tel Aviv was a young city in its infancy. And the mayor was Dizengoff. Okay, we all recognize that name, right? And Churchill was coming to visit Tel Aviv at Dizengoff's invitation. And he was extremely excited. Everybody was excited. This great man is coming. He wanted to have the most impressive kind of welcome that he could figure out. So he sends the municipal workers of Tel Aviv all over Israel to take palm trees from wherever they are and line the parade route with palm trees so that this parade route, now I think it's Rothschild Road or something. Is there a place like that in Tel Aviv? It's like a big thoroughfare. Anyway, it was like, okay. So Rothschild Road was what it was. And they stick palm trees all the way down that road, all the way down that boulevard. And it's very impressive. A huge number of Israelis come, and Diesengoff and Churchill proudly march down this beautiful sight, and it's a very warm welcome. And Diesengoff gets up to the dais to introduce the great man, to introduce Churchill. This is Israel, right? In Israel, what happens if somebody can't see over the person in front of them's head? What are you going to do? You climb to the top of the palm tree. So one by one, all the Israelis who couldn't see well, they climb, the kids and the adults, climb to the top of the palm tree. But these palm trees weren't very well planted. And like dominoes, to Diesengoff's horror, one tree after another starts falling. It must have been an incredible scene. It's reported in the Israeli newspapers the next day, I think in Haaretz or something. Okay? Literally, dominoes. Nobody was seriously hurt from what I read, but it sounds like it was a pretty horrifying experience for Diesengoff, who was incredibly embarrassed. And Churchill is trying to choke back his laughter, and he sees how upset Diesengoff is, and puts his arm around him, and he says, "Mayor Diesengoff, if you want to build a city and you want to build a country, you have to pay attention to the roots. You have to pay attention to the roots." That's what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is digital technology is a wonderful root system. Part of its attraction is it connects us to the narrative of our lives and those that we feel most deeply about. Okay, when you are able to check your cell phones after this talk, you may hear about plans with other family members or who's coming over for a barbecue later tonight, or colleagues who you need to meet with later this week, or even about a shear that's being given somewhere, whatever it might be. And that's wonderful. But to the extent that the new research is showing that when you mainly have your roots and your connection around looking down, not looking up, and around the superficial kind of shot of dopamine, little short, impersonal sentences, that's the shallow roots. That's the roots that are not the roots we want. Spirituality, our Judaism, our core values are connected to deeper roots. And those roots can only take hold if we pay attention to the Vavadate Mehera and the Kamayim Apanim Opanim of face-to-face contact. Thank you, everybody. Wow.